it's a bite-sized piece of script.
Quick to read.
Okay. There's 20 paragraphs in here. Sit down and read it very quickly within the space of a couple of hours. And it's focused very much on one particular topic. So I really enjoy the four doctrines for the same reason. Okay.
Is there a word translation?
I'm not sure.
Yes. Soul-body interaction, it's called.
Yes.
Because intercourse was seen to be too sexual.
And
George novel, and it is published, but it appears in the Studious Reader of Young, which is a periodic, was a periodic magazine in the stories.
Thank you for that, I have one.
And are there any of the bookshops that you know of?
I think there is. I'll have to check up on that.
I'm not sure it's Dole, because it's in English.
Yes, I'll check into it and get back to you.
So just a few little facts about this book. It was written and published in 1769, published between Conjugal Love and True Christian Religion. So it's the second last. Now, before I started researching this book for today, I'd always been of the opinion that the idea of the soul was pretty much dead in philosophy and science. What I discovered is that it is not. So I found there's a website which is called the National Center, this is American, the National Center for Biotechnology Information. And this has a list of a variety of scientific, and particularly scientific or philosophical papers with a scientific interest. And so two of those papers, one was called Soul Searching, A Brief History of the Mind-Body Debate in the Neurosciences, and another one, The Anatomic Location of the Soul, From the Heart Through the Brain to the Whole Body and Beyond, A Journey Through Western History, Science, and Philosophy. Now, those two papers were published in 2007 and 2009. Mm. And that was a surprise.
Never heard of
that. No, they don't both quote this book. I found the site because I went looking for Swedenborg.
What's the name of the site again?
National Center for Biotechnology Information. It is the website is ncbi.nlm.nih.gov.
But they're not exactly hanging out for
so, and it's all very technical and scientific and academic and that sort of thing. But there's a list of a lot of, I thought, quite interesting articles. You could pop Swedenborg, for example, in the search field, and you'll come up with a number of papers that mention Swedenborg, I mean, particularly for his contribution to the science of the brain. Okay. The other thing that I'll just mention is this book, which was brought to my attention by Joe Vandermeer. Those of you who know Joe from Sydney, he will have talked about this in Sydney, I think.
He certainly
brought it down to Canberra, and I thought, right, I've got to have a copy of this. And very cool book, Pim van Lommel, Consciousness Beyond Life, The Science of Near-Death Experience. And van Lommel simply says this: the mind can change the brain. How could a product be able to change its own producer? Okay. And in lots of ways, that simple question encapsulates what this book, Intercourse of the Soul and Body, is about. The second thing to say before I go on to into here is that it is not a theological work. In my view now, it is actually a philosophical work with implications for science and theology. Okay, and you'll get a sense of this as I start to read. I'm actually going to begin at the end, or almost the end. There are 20 paragraphs, and I'm going to read at least part of 19. And it's a memorable relation. To these observations, I will add this memorable relation. After these pages were written, I prayed to the Lord that I might be permitted to converse with some of the disciples of Aristotle, and at the same time with some disciples of Descartes, and with some disciples of Leibniz, in order that I might learn the opinions of their minds concerning the intercourse of the soul and the body. After my prayer was ended, there came 9 men, 3 Aristotelians, 3 Cartesians, and 3 Leibnizians, and stood around me, the admirers of Aristotle being on the left side, the followers of Descartes on the right, and the favourers of Leibniz behind, which is rather interesting to have a conversation with people who stand behind. At a considerable distance, and also at a distance from one another, I saw 3 persons crowned, as it were, with laurel, whom I knew by an inflowing perception to be those 3 great leaders or masters themselves. Behind Leibniz stood a person holding the skirt of his garment, who I was told was Wolff. Those 9 men, that's the admirers, when they beheld one another, at first saluted one another with courteous speech and talked together. But presently there arose from below a spirit with a torch in his right hand, which he shook before their faces, whereupon they became enemies, 3 against 3, and looked fiercely at one another. For they were seized with the lust of altercation and dispute. Then the Aristotelians, who were also schoolmen, began to speak, saying, "Who does not see that objects flow through the senses into the soul, as a man enters through the doors into a chamber, and that the soul thinks according to such influx? When a lover sees a beautiful virgin or his bride, does not his eye sparkle and transmit the love of her into the soul? When a miser sees bags of money, does he not burn towards them with every sense, and thence cause this ardour to enter the soul and excite the desire of possessing them? When a proud man hears himself praised by another, does he not prick up his ears, and do not these transmit those praises to the soul? Are not the senses of the body like outer courts, through which alone entrance is obtained to the soul? From these considerations and innumerable others of a similar nature, who can conclude otherwise than that influx proceeds from nature or is physical?" While they were speaking thus, the followers of Descartes held their fingers on their foreheads, and now withdrawing them, they replied, saying, "Ah, you speak from appearances. Do you not know that the eye does not love a virgin or bride from itself, but from the soul? And likewise that the senses of the body do not covet the bags of money from themselves, but from the soul. And also that the ears do not devour the praises of flatterers in any other manner. Is it not perception that causes sensation? And perception is of the soul and not of the bodily organ. Say, if you can, what causes the tongue and lips to speak but the thought? And what causes the hands to work but the will? And thought and will are of the soul and not of the body. Thus, what causes the eye to see and the ears to hear and the other organs to feel but the soul? From these considerations and innumerable others of a similar kind, everyone whose wisdom rises above the things of the bodily senses concludes that there is no influx of the body into the soul, but of the soul into the body, which influx we call occasional and also spiritual influx. When these had been heard, the three men who stood behind the former group of three, and who were the favourers of Leibniz, began to speak, saying, "We have heard the arguments on both sides and have compared them, and we have perceived that in many particulars the latter are stronger than the former." That is, Descartes is stronger than Aristotle. "And that in many others the former are stronger than the latter. Wherefore, if you please, we will adjust the dispute." On being asked how, they replied, "There is not any influx of the soul into the body, nor of the body into the soul, but there is a unanimous and instantaneous operation of both together, to which a celebrated author has assigned an elegant name by calling it pre-established harmony." That's Leibniz. After this, the spirit with the torch appeared again. Now, however, the torch was in his left hand, and he shook it behind their heads, whence the ideas of them all became confused, and they cried out at once, "Neither our soul nor our body knows which side we should take. Wherefore, let us settle this dispute by lot, and we will abide by the lot which comes out first." So they took three pieces of paper and wrote on one of them, "physical influx," on the other, "spiritual influx," and on the third, "pre-established harmony." And they put them all into the crown of a hat. Then they chose one of their number to draw, who on putting in his hand, took out that on which was written "spiritual influx." Having seen and read it, they all said, some with a clear and flowing, some with a faint and indrawn voice, "Let us abide by this because it came out first." But then an angel suddenly stood by and said, "Do not imagine that the paper in favour of spiritual influx came out first by chance, for it was of providence. Because you are in confused ideas, you do not see its truth, but the very truth presented itself to the hand of him that drew the lots, that you might yield it your assent." And that really, that little memorable relation really captures a lot of what the book is about. Now, from here on in, I have to say my knowledge of philosophy is schoolboy. So please forgive me. And June, you were talking about studying philosophy. So if you have anything to say, I will be most pleased to hear it. So we have these three figures. We have Descartes. We have Aristotle. And we have Leibniz. All very influential figures in terms of the academic life and indeed the scientific life of Swedenborg's own time. I don't know how much you know about these. I know now a great deal more than I did about a month ago, but that's still not a lot, but a little.
I think the Leibniz and Descartes lived at a similar time, and Aristotle, of course, lived in the ancient Greeks.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the time Swedenborg lived, the Age of Enlightenment, I think in music I can think about the classical period, which occurs just after Swedenborg has, while Swedenborg's, the latter end of Swedenborg's life, and then on beyond that. Very much of looking back to the Greeks in lots of ways. Not only Aristotle, but Plato also. Plato also fall under here a bit as well. So Descartes lived 1596 to 1650. His friend. There's a great, if anybody wants to look at it, there's a great video of a bloke called Bernard Williams on Descartes, Now, it would have come out in the 70s or the 80s, I imagine, but it's up on YouTube, and this is one of the ways I learned about Descartes. But if you want to look for Bernard Williams on Descartes on YouTube, there's about 4 or 5 installments of this video. It's just an interview with him and this other chap, and it's quite informative. An interview with Bernard Williams on Descartes. Descartes came up with this. He had what was called a method of doubt. And his method of doubt was he was trying to come to truth. What is truth? So he decided to discard anything that he could possibly harbour any doubt about. And Bernard Williams talks about a couple of experiments that he does in order to do this. And one of them is the idea that discarding on the basis of doubt because I might be dreaming. So Descartes talks about the idea that when you're dreaming, you feel very much as though you are awake, and that your perceptions are very real. So, you know, you will have had the experience of waking up in a sweat, for example, because you have felt your dreams being real. So Descartes therefore dismisses a lot of the sensory information we take on board because we might be dreaming. The other thing a thought experiment he tries, is the idea of the evil spirit. That he imagines that, okay, I might not be dreaming, but imagine that there is an evil spirit who is out to fool me. What is there about my experience of the world that might be beyond being falsified? And really, he discounts physical experience, in its entirety. So on the basis of those two things, that I might be dreaming or I might be being led astray by an evil spirit. So I can't necessarily really trust my experience of the physical world as a means of getting to truth. Now this is where he comes up with his famous little saying. Does anybody know it?
I think, therefore I am.
Because he finds that the one thing that I can't be fooled into thinking of is that I exist. I think, therefore I am. An evil spirit can't make me think I don't exist, because even if he's fooling me about everything else, he can't be fooling me about the fact that I exist. So, I think, therefore I am. Now, Descartes also, the other thing that he thinks that must be true is the idea of God. Because he comes to the conclusion that I can't make up God because I am lesser than God. The idea of God must be implanted by God himself. So he comes up with those two things as really being the foundation of truth. Or a foundation of truth that he cannot deny, or that he cannot doubt in any way. The interesting thing about Descartes is that's really where he leaves God. God simply then is the guarantor of all subsequent knowledge. And if you follow that path far enough, as people in Swedenborg's own time did, you end up with a thing called deism. Is everybody familiar with deism? Deism is simply the idea that God created the world and stepped back and let it run. So deism discounts revelation. Okay? There's no such thing as revelation because God simply created the world and then he stepped back and no longer has any part in it. So revelation, of course, the Bible is put to one side, and ideas of incarnation, of course, are all out as far as the deists go. So that's Descartes, and he represents in this book the spiritual influx idea. Now we also have the other figure who presents this sort of idea is actually Plato. Now, although Plato does not come into this book at all, Plato's concept was a world of forms. The world of forms is really the sense that an ideal can exist without having something to exist in. Okay. Now for Plato, this is where the soul resides too. And there's lots of tie-ins with the idea of the spiritual world for us. That's my reading of it. But these are ideals that they exist. They don't need to exist in an object, but they exist in an object because they exist in the world of forms, you see.
I think my understanding of Plato is one of the things that he described was the idea of a table. We think of a table as being built or invented because it's useful to put things on and eat around. Plato came up with the idea that not necessarily was that the creative idea behind the table. He said, a table actually exists because it actually represents some kind of spiritual use or spiritual form, spiritual value. And that's where a table came from. And I think when you think about that, you can see that he's actually not that far away from a knowledge of correspondences or an idea of the correspondences in a way that we definitely see that.
The other word I want to put up here is rationalism. Now, rationalism is the idea. Let me read this so I get it right. Rationalism is any view appealing to reason as a source of knowledge or justification. In more technical terms, it is a method or a theory in which the criterion of the truth is not sensory, but intellectual and deductive. Now, that contrasts with Aristotle, and the word that we use here is empiricism. Now, this is all to do with science, this is all to do with experimentation. That you make an experiment and you draw conclusions from your experiment. Okay? So this is very much in the physical world. I'm just going to read some things here because it expresses it far better than I can do. Like his teacher, Plato, Aristotle's philosophy aimed at the universal. Aristotle, however, found the universal in particular things, which he called the essence of things, while Plato found that the universal exists apart from particular things and is related to them as their prototype or exemplar. Plato argued that there are some universal forms that are not a part of particular things. For example, it is possible that there is no particular good in existence, but good is still a proper universal form. So that's Plato in his world of forms. For Plato, philosophic method meant the descent from a knowledge of universal forms to a contemplation of particular imitations of these, so from the spiritual to the physical, the natural. For Aristotle, philosophic method implies the ascent from the study of particular phenomena to the knowledge of essences. For Aristotle, form still refers to the unconditional basis of phenomena, but this word is instantiated in particular substance. So Aristotle really says a quality such as good doesn't exist unless it exists in a physical object, in a thing that we can study. And we can take that thing and we can learn what the quality is. That's the Aristotelian view. So according to Aristotle, the form of an apple exists within each apple rather than in the world of forms. So this is physical influx.
I thought when you read out the book that it mentioned the other one that got cross-mixed. Maybe I just heard it wrong.
Okay. Yes, so Aristotle is very definitely on the idea of physical influx.
Yeah, just when you read the The booklet.
The book?
Yeah.
Then you have this one, Leibniz. This was the bit that I was unfamiliar with, particularly, and this was a term that sort of jumped out at me as soon as I started reading the book, and it was the pre-established harmony. Leibniz's idea is quite interesting. Leibniz comes up with this idea of things he calls monads. Now, monads are sort of essential substances or essential things, but he uses this term windowless to suggest that they are completing themselves. So one of the examples that I read is that when a glass is dropped on the ground, the glass doesn't shatter because it hits the ground. The glass shatters because it knows it needs to. Right? So the glass has within it a representation of the physical world which requires it to shatter when it hits the ground. But it's not the hitting of the ground that makes it shatter.
Why doesn't a beer know it needs to be in my fridge?
So have a listen to this. Leibniz's theory of pre-established harmony is a philosophical theory about causation under which every substance only affects itself, but all the substances, both bodies and minds, in the world nevertheless seem to causally interact with each other because they have been programmed by God in advance to harmonize with each other. Leibniz's term for these substances were monads, which he described as being windowless. So no connection with the outside world. They are within themselves a sealed package. Leibniz's theory is best known as a solution to the mind-body problem of how mind can interact with the body. It can also be noted that if a mind behaves as a windowless monad, there is no need for any other object to exist in order to create that mind's sense perception.
That's on the way to solipsism.
Yes. I didn't put that word in here because I couldn't say it. But yes, that's what they said next. Which means
that nothing else exists except you and your perception that other things exist for you. Mm. It's total, utter loneliness.
Yes. Now, going on, however, Leibniz claims that his principle of harmony, according to which God creates the best and most harmonious world possible, dictates that the perceptions of each monad expresses the world in its entirety, and the world expressed by the monad actually exists. Although Leibniz says that each monad is windowless, he also claims that it functions as a mirror of the entire creative universe. So the theory is that we could be that, but if you take Leibniz as a whole, he's saying that what exists within the monad is a true reflection of what exists out there.
That's
interesting. Okay. I sort of hear correspondences in this a little bit.
I hear copper.
Okay. Well, you get a sense of this, don't you, in this passage. So, you have this debate between followers of Aristotle go first, and they talk about this physical influx, the idea that, you know, you see a virgin or you see your bride and you are inflamed with desire. Okay, and so that's then transmitted to the soul. Then the followers of Descartes come and say, no, it's the other way around. Okay? It's what is in the soul that flows down through the mind and into the body. And then there's the followers of Leibniz who really can't make up their mind.
We have them in this today, they're called the Me Generation.
The Me Generation.
Everybody else exists to keep all matters to me.
Yes. There's one other character, and that is Christian Wolff, who was the one who was said to be holding the skirt tails of Leibniz, another German philosopher, who very much went along with sort of pushing Leibniz's idea, and those two were apparently the most important German philosophers until Immanuel Kant. Okay. I don't really want to dwell on Wolff, because he just says the same thing more or less. So, where do I want to go with all of this? What I want to say is, as I said at the beginning, is that the argument is not dead. All this stuff is still...
Age, immortality, it'll always be there. Everyone starts to think about it, it's like, what is inside of us we are given to think about while we're always there? And you know, there's... None of those, there's only one philosopher, Rudolf Steiner, that actually advocates pre-existence. And he thinks we are all spiritual entities before we come on the earth. So then that would tie in with us coming down to earth and having a spiritual, we are just born into a body, you know? And yeah. When we die, we leave our body, the spirit goes up again. But yeah, it's quite a few years since I read too many philosophers. But no, none of those philosophers, in fact, probably Descartes, probably a bit near his spiritual influence. But Plato is the one that really spoke more about love than anything, because that's how Platonic love comes from Plato. And he did a lot of talking about love. But none of the others seem to concentrate much on love. Rudolf Steiner, with his pre-existence, also has personalities and people categorized into like about four main groups of people. And they, when Leibniz talks about pre-established harmony, the people then harmonize together. And if you put some of the groups of people together, they won't get on. It's better if they're more with the ones that they harmonise. There's loads of stuff out there, and minds could just explode. They do often, you know.
What you see happening, I think, through certain, you know, in Swedenborg's career, the time in which he lived, is the very, very strong influence of Aristotle's work on the scientific world and the scientific method. Certainly Descartes was incredibly influential, but this seems to be the path that science has really gone. The idea that by looking at the physical world, we can deduce certain principles, prior principles. Okay, so that's very much the idea. Looking down helps us to look up.
He turned his right around here. Cool. Although he just up until like 200 years ago, everybody looked down. They looked down as the way the world was influenced by whatever was above. But the re-embracing of Aristotle enabled us to turn the all the way around to the world today, which is we look up from what we have. There's nothing above until we put it there. Sort of thing. It's completely opposite.
I'm wondering how much Leibniz now is involved in the concept of entanglement. You know, in quantum physics.
Yeah, there's definitely quantum theory.
The idea of entanglement is that, you know, qualia or whatever they call the stuff. Quantum whatever's. No one actually knows what they are.
Bosons, quarks.
Yeah, are actually related in the sense that it doesn't matter how far apart they are. If the position of one, not position, but the state of one changes, that state will be reflected in the part. It's not a particle, but in the in the form that it's entangled with, whether that's, you know, something at the end of the room or something 20 billion light years away. It's simultaneous. So it kind of sounds a bit like Leibniz.
And that's faster than the speed of light.
Yeah, it's immediate.
Yeah.
There's no...
Can I just again read a couple of things? One of the things I found is that what's called the mind-body problem, very much referred to in this book. So the mind-body problem arises because mental phenomena arguably differ in kind from the physical body. So Leibniz wrote this: it must be confessed that perception and that which depends on it are inexplicable by mechanical causes, that is, by figures and motions. And supposing that there was a mechanism so constructed as to think, feel, and perceive, we might enter into it as into a mill. And this being granted, we should only find, on visiting it, pieces which push one against another, but never anything by which to explain a perception. This must be sought, therefore, in the simple substance, and not in the composite or the machine. Now, in this book, this talks about quantum theory, and there are two gentlemen by the name of Stuart Hammerhoff and Roger Penrose. Some of you might know Roger Penrose's name. According to an anaesthetist, this bloke, but that's a much longer word I can't read, Stuart Hammerhoff and mathematician and physicist Roger Penrose, microtubules, which are tiny structural components of the skeleton cells that are involved in many cellular processes inside neurons, may initiate information processes via self-organizing patterns that trigger coherent states, and these might explain our ability to experience consciousness. Their suggestion is based in part on the still speculative theory of a quantum gravity, which tries to reconcile or unify the theories of quantum mechanics and general relativity. And if you understood any of that, then you will realise that they are looking for a physical basis for consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, some people actually think it's the empathetic nerve sort of driving that, you know?
Okay.
As it, yeah, just, yeah, it goes bonkers, you know, that's it.
But this is where science is at a lot of the time. And now,
the nature of the woman.
Van Lommel is interesting in the way he treats it. He says, well, this is the way that is, and then he sort of seems to set it aside without really wanting to contradict it or affirm it. So I sort of get the sense, well, these are guys who will actually talk to me, so I'm not going to offend them, but I really don't go along that sort of lines of thinking. Van Lommel ends up really, to me, certainly getting into the spiritual world and almost mentioning God, but not quite. So now what I want to do is I just want to think about a few things. The book in itself doesn't really present anything new to me in that it really is very much expressing a particular issue that Swedenborg addresses throughout his writings. It just collects these ideas together. So there are things that are reminiscent of divine love and wisdom and then other parts of the writings.
Is there any way you can expand on what you just said? What's Swedenborg? Is Swedenborg the theme that you're saying?
Swedenborg comes down very firmly on the side of Descartes and spiritual influx. So what he's saying is that everything flows from the spiritual into the natural. And ultimately, it flows from the divine into the spiritual, into the natural. Nothing flows the other way. Right? There's no influence the other way. Okay? It's all you might describe as down or out from what is internal to what is external. So very, very heavily. And you get that sense right from word go, right from the first paragraph in this book, where he introduces the arguments. That's where he is all the way.
And interestingly, he predates Swedenborg, so we get involved with that.
Yeah. But what I want to do is I want to get you thinking about things like Feng Shui.
Feng Shui?
Yeah.
What is it?
It's the art of ambience and the influence and like the energy. If you place something in the room there, it will attract the energy there for a certain thing. So it's colours and items, and it's Japanese and Chinese. Mm.
So there is a physical thing which is supposed to bring about a spiritual change?
Yeah. Yeah, but the physical... the funny thing is that the mere fact that you're changing it physically is because you're changing things spiritually.
True. Both ways that works.
You know,
because the art of auto-suggestion in psychology is a powerful thing. And when you were talking about something else, or something amongst all that, about the mind, you know, if a person's very, well, we all know this day and age, like sleeping and food and all the rest of it, and he studied all of those, if someone's completely... their thinking is way out and they're suffering and really troubling with something, they can go to a psychiatrist, not just a psychologist. Psychologists are not as deep a level as psychiatrists. Psychiatrists can really delve into it much more, and they can talk to this person, get out from them what's troubling, go back, work out things with them, and that person will come to enlightenment, and then perhaps go on to a better, smoother life and forget what it was that was really troubling them. So the mind, it's like in conjunction with, would have to be in conjunction with God as well, working out and the spiritual influx coming in. And how can that person perceive their world then fresher and newer and better? So it's tied up, really. And then you came to empiricism with Aristotle. Logic and values in the court system is based totally on empirical statements, not ad hominem, which are ad hoc arguments. That doesn't work at all. And so, it was fascinating. How many hours have we got?
What about medication? I mean, you've mentioned that to the psychiatrist.
That's a difference between the psychologist and the psychiatrist, the ability to prescribe medication.
Yes.
The medication doesn't obviously...
It does.
Medication has an effect, but it's only an effect because it's spiritual.
It's only temporary. It's a mind-altering drug, some of the medication, but it's not often used. Only if it's really, really necessary, then it's usually only used for and monitored until they get over that little hill. But basically, yes, you're right.
It's used all the time.
Oh, the doctors do it.
Yeah,
doctors do it.
First line.
Psychiatrists can prescribe real drugs that are totally will affect that person. But I mean, we can't say too much about that. We're people in the world. We can't judge anyone. We even drink alcohol. That alters our mind.
Medication alters the state of the recipient. So it's not the medication. Yeah, the medication doesn't do it. It's the influx.
No, it's the medication. That's why psychiatrists do go.
And that is why homeopathy is a powerful state.
Well, you could say the same for nutrition. I mean, there's all kinds of things, not just medication, but anything that you can do.
I've been thinking about that, so I want to read.
There's nothing in the world that's true.
I like that way of putting it, David. That's right.
The receiving vessel status change, which alters the nature of it.
I mean, you could say it's a disease.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, that's true. So, look, when I talk about myself, I know when I go into a certain house, or certain houses, like particularly where there's a lot of mess, I know I feel agitated. Okay. So it seems as though there is a physical reality that I walk into that is having a spiritual effect on me. But that's not the case according to what Swedenborg teaches about spiritual influx. It's more about the receiving vessels. I think about the idea of a radio tuning in to certain frequencies. So the frequencies are always there, but the radio hones in on a particular one. So for whatever reason, I am in a place where I am honing into a particular frequency when that occurs to me. Whereas some people would walk into a messy room and it doesn't affect them at all. So there's something about my state when I do that. It's not about the messy room itself bringing about a state in me. I like the way you put that. Medication alters the state of the receiving vessel. If anybody likes writing down numbers, they can write this one down. AC1563. And I might read it actually, it's longish, but it's worth it. The external man receives his life principally from the internal, that is from his spirit or soul. From there comes his life itself in general, which life cannot be received by the external man in a detailed and distinct manner unless his organic vessels are opened, which are to serve as recipients of the particular and individual parts of the internal man, is the idea of vessels. Those organic vessels that are to serve as recipients are not opened except by means of the senses, chiefly those of hearing and sight. And as they are so open, the internal man is able to flow in with the particular and individual parts. They are opened by means of the senses, through facts and cognitions, as well as through pleasures and delights, the former being things of the understanding, the latter those of the will. From these considerations, it becomes clear that as an inevitable result, facts and cognitions, that's in the intellect, the understanding, which cannot agree with spiritual truths, will worm their way into the external man. And that pleasures and delights which cannot agree with celestial good will worm their way in, even as all those things which do regard bodily, worldly, and earthly things as ends in themselves. Which things, when regarded as ends, drag the external man outwards and downwards, and so remove the external man from the internal man. For this reason, unless such things have first been dispelled, the internal man cannot in any way agree with the external. And therefore, before the internal man is able to agree with the external, such things have to be removed. It's talking about the separation of Lot and Abram. Okay. The other thing we could think about also is things like the Holy Supper. This was a question that was thrown at me a couple of weeks back. In what way is the Holy Supper spiritually beneficial?
Well, it's community, isn't it? I mean, the table, the sharing of the supper is all what came before, washing the feet, washing the hands. We don't wash each other's feet. That's what I see the teaching as, and it's hospitality open. For me, open, whatever the level.
There has no benefit whatsoever.
No benefit whatsoever.
No benefit whatsoever.
What did you say? I'm sorry, I didn't, can't hear down here, the acoustics.
I agree with what you said.
Oh.
But the Holy Supper itself has no benefit whatsoever because it doesn't fulfill the things that you said.
The supper doesn't?
No. Because it's not a time of fellowship. It's not a time of sharing a meal together. It's purely a religious formula, ritual.
But he was in it.
Who?
Jesus.
No, Jesus was in a supper 2,000 years ago in the upper floors of a house.
Oh, you're talking about... Disciples. Okay, well, it depends.
When you use the term Holy Supper, you're talking about the religious... ritual that takes place in church, really, aren't you? Otherwise, you wouldn't put the term holy in front of it, would you? I mean, I wouldn't say, we'll come over to my place and we'll have a holy supper together. I just say, come over, you know, and we'll have supper.
And there's benefit to the extent that you want it to have benefit.
Yeah.
It's what you want.
To the extent you let it have benefit.
It brings you focus, it gives you something to focus on, and at that time the little bird comes around, then you can think, and then you wait for the little line, and then you stay there a little while, and then you can say private prayers. And so it's very good for focusing, and then you feel calm and past it.
The benefit is what you bring to it, really. The intention and what you're personally kind of working on and praying for.
And it's also a wonderful way of wishing to receive goodness and truth within you. Mm-hmm. And I see that as the legacy of Jesus having the Holy Supper and to continue down through the centuries. It's seen as one of the sacraments that Jesus instituted, and do this in memory of me. And the way Julian does it, I think, is terrific, where he quotes passages from the Gospels of the Holy Supper scene, and it represents us communing with the divine in this physical way that makes it real for us. And even though it's sometimes doesn't have the atmosphere of a lovely family meal, still it has a special quality to it.
Mm. Yeah. See, people say the Holy Supper is a correspondence, but there's no correspondence in the Holy Supper either, because correspondence comes from use. And the use of eating is to give us strength, and the use of drinking is to quench our thirst, but we don't do those things in the Holy Supper. We don't eat to satisfy our hunger, we don't drink to quench our thirst. We do them for completely different reasons, mostly to do with ritual. And if they provide a meditative period of time, there's nothing wrong with that. That's good. But it's not a correspondence.
Well, isn't Matthew, you know, the wedding feast, isn't that a similar correspondence with that? Inviting them from
the here. Wedding feast was an actual wedding feast, and as such, yes, it was definitely a correspondence.
Because he invited different those who didn't come. He first invited, in the end, he had to go out to the whole, you know, the countryside.
That's right. But if you go to a Jewish wedding and they have a single glass of wine and then crush the glass underneath, that's not a correspondence. They're not drinking the wine for a use. It's just symbolic. It's just ritual. And there's no correspondence in ritual. So only correspondence in a use. So that satisfies your thirst, then the fluid, whether it's water or wine or whatever it is, has a use. If it satisfies your hunger, then the food, whatever it is, has a use. The Old Testament sacrifices were part of a festival where they ate at the end and satisfied their hunger with the sacrifices. So they had a use as well as being ritual, religious ritual. But we don't do that with the Lord's Supper. We don't use it for anything apart from a religious ceremony.
Unless you're drawing a connection to the Lord.
Yeah.
And then it has a corresponding.
Well, then it's a, well, you know, you started off this talking about, no, maybe it was the previous one, but talking about the things that we do to draw our attention. Oh, no, I can't tell you. But I thought to myself, yeah, a lot of them are actual rituals. And as such, they're nice. They're pleasant, you know. They're sweet. But they don't really serve any purpose other than creating an environment in which we might be meditative or quiet with the Lord or, you know. But I think we should talk about what the church is for, actually, this morning. See, really the point of the church is for us to get together in fellowship within a community that is outside, as it were, of the world. That we're creating, as it were. we're a community within itself, that in which we can, for want of a better word, insulate ourselves from the values of the world. And it's very effective for that purpose. And sometimes when we think about witnessing or going out to the world, we forget that the main thing that we have is what the world wants. It's a relationship, it's a fellowship, it's a quality of being together, which the world lacks. That's why we do it. That's why we form a church. Because we are existing, as it were, in a dimension that doesn't exist outside of us. And ideally, the world comes into, wants to come into that dimension. So we have to be careful when we go out of that dimension into the world that we don't destroy it in the process of trying to make it more palatable for the rest of the world to come into. This is what churches have done in the past. They have tried to get rid of so much within themselves. And a lot of the times it's not the ritual that they get rid of, it's other things. But they have tried to get rid of so much, the world knows no longer attracted to it, because they have lost what was most essential, which is the reality of their relationship together. Now, does the Lord's Supper add anything to that reality? Well, not really. I've often thought that we actually do more, we more closely personify the Lord's Supper in the morning tea that we have after the service than we do in what we have in the service. Because you think about it, in the morning tea, we have a drink of tea which we need, you know, by the end of the service. We have a biscuit which stays off the hunger. So both those things are forming you. And we are fellowshipping together. We are rejoining the bonds, rebuilding the bonds that we have with each other that create the community that's so attractive in the world, to the world.
I think that for me anyway, the purpose of the Holy Supper is not so much the sense of community with the other people there. Maybe I'm just a very isolated person. But it's much more a ritual that expresses my relationship with the Lord. So it doesn't create a relationship with the Lord. It's meaningless if there's not at least some level of openness to a relationship with the Lord. But for me, you know, the bread and the wine, different ways to relate to the Lord with love and with wisdom. And it just expresses that in a physical form, which I find very powerful. Different from after morning tea or whatever. Because that is, for me, more about social interaction and also, you know, physical hunger and all that stuff. So not so much with the biscuits, that's just more for pleasure, but whatever.
I'm saying, I see it more as a contract, you know, that you renew. You know, you got your clause, your options to extend it. And every time you're in front of that table, you know, you extend that contract and say, yes, Lord, I reaffirm my commitment. I acknowledge that all that is good comes from you. I accept that all that is truth comes from you, reality comes from you, and I give myself to you. That's what that is. It's like a contract, and the only way that we can actually sort of do that in a terminating way, right, in its ultimate way, I suppose, because you can think it, which would probably be sufficient, but by doing the act, you're finalising and making that commitment, how do you call it, terminate, concrete, more real. That's the use for me of Holy Supper.
I'm going to jump in before anybody else says anything, because we've actually run out of time. But just to say, there's a little of both in this, in that the Holy Supper can mean nothing
Absolutely.
It can mean nothing. And this is where the question that I got was from. Someone who'd been raised in the Catholic Church and felt as a result of all of that, that it meant nothing. So it certainly can mean nothing, but it can certainly mean a great deal, as it does. And the difference is the receiving vessel. And if you read what Swedenborg says about the Holy Suffering, that's where he lands, really. It's the receiving vessel. That's us, as the way we take it. But I do want to stop there because I'm stepping on Julian's time. But do have a read of this very easy little book. I highly recommend it.
David?
Thank you.
I just mentioned that I gave a presentation on the interaction of the soul and the body, and I was going to base the talk on that book, but after I read it, I found it a bit dry. That was my perception, and I fortunately found him talking about it in the Arcana. There's a section in the Arcana between the chapters dealing with the interaction between the soul and the body, and I found that much more interesting. And so I'll just mention that, just in case people mightn't be aware of it, that there is another part of his writings that deals with it.
Do you know where?
Yes, I can tell you in the 5:30 session. I'll look it up in my computer and let you know what the numbers are.
It's interesting Thanks, you Mike. Say that, because I felt that I was, as you were reading in the beginning, I thought, I haven't read this book, but I've read those words. And that would be it. It must be somewhere in the academy.
That's right.
Thanks, Dave.